I think we need, the committee needs to hear what the significance of reporting or non-reporting amounts to.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, why you report it anyway, and what good does it do, and what's the purpose?
Sure. Madam Chair.
And they aren't being sentenced, it doesn't mean that it isn't going that way. You know, we need to know a little bit about Table 1 and what that does or doesn't do for us.
Okay. Madam Chair, if I could.
Square one.
The importance of the information coming to the council in whatever form it takes is that that information is entered daily. We get about 750 of these forms a month. It's entered daily into a computer. It's what enables us to answer questions like, if we want to increase the penalty for possession of a pound of cocaine to X level, how many prison beds will it take? It allows us to track things like changes in sentencing patterns as they're related to race or gender, changes in the type of crimes that are being prosecuted in the courts. So to the extent that we don't have the information from a county, we don't know very well what's going on in that county. In terms of getting an overall state picture, Catherine is able to fill in the missing information in a way that lets us feel fairly confident about statewide projections, but it would be very difficult to tell you the answer to a specific question about a specific county if that county was not reporting to us very well. Interestingly enough, the counties that do report well ask for their piece of the, we send them the computer disk with their information on it so they can do their own pieces of information about future jail construction and future community corrections plans. So for the counties that do report, there's a benefit for them as well. Is that responsive to your question, Senator?
I think so. Senator Hamby, further questions right now? Anything else?
The counties that you mentioned, first of all, Kathy, help me understand. Table 1 identifies even local felons, the new jails that you mentioned.
Let me let Catherine speak to Table 1.
The jails are not in Table 1 at all.
They're not in Table 1 at all.
No. Let's talk. Do you have a table on jails?
Catherine, do you want to go to Table 1 and explain what Table 1 is just for a second?
Table 1, for the record, is an enumeration of the number of sentencing reports on felons sentenced under the guidelines that we've got the form back on by county. Some go into jail, some go into prison.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have a jail report table in this booklet in terms of the number of people in the jails and those changes?
Senator Cohen, the most recent jail report is not in your booklet. We could certainly get one to every member.
This has nothing. Okay. Right now, we're not talking anything about jails.
No.
This doesn't have any bearing to Kathleen's statement about the jail population. That's another outcome that is happened when people got sentenced under guidelines. They were no longer being sentenced to the local county jail system because they got a longer period of time. That's theory.
No, my surprise. I knew Washington County was not reporting. However, the three counties that she mentioned that had recently built new jails, as I glanced at the counties, I recognized that the percent of total was significantly higher for those three counties with small populations.
Mm-hmm.
And perhaps it's just that they're
just, I think it's an indication that they're on top of their system better. All of their systems better.
The ones that are supposedly accurately accounting for it are the highest percentages in there.
Yes, right.
I mean.
So that fits pretty well what you'd expect. Anything else before we move on? Yeah, I think this is an indication of that some of us are new here, and some of us forget real quickly, so you need to take us back to the elementary kinds of things and as you proceed, because it's easier for it.
Okay.
Madam Chair, Senator
Hill.
I'm sorry. What is going to be done now to make sure that we get better reporting? You mentioned something I would like to.
Madam Chair and Senator Hill, there are a number of efforts underway to get the problem fixed, because it is extremely important to receive the information so we know how it's working out there. I think the most useful thing will be the uniform judgment legislation. There's a bill that we're having introduced before this committee that would call for all the courts in the state to use a uniform judgment in sentencing felons. As it is now, the county judgments are extremely different in form. Most of them are narrative. They don't include the kind of information that we need in order to monitor the populations. We're suggesting that there be a uniform judgment, that it include the things that we need. The courts fill it out. It is the judgment, and the council would be happy with just getting the fifth copy of that. And we could enter the data from that into the computers, and we would never again have to print, distribute, or receive back the sentencing report forms, which is a separate document that the court is responsible for filling out. Most courts have delegated it to district attorney's offices, and district attorney's offices have had a hard time fitting it into their workload. So we're trying to come up with a simpler way to do it so that there's no necessity to create an extra document that needs to be forwarded in the system.
And this is a pretty user-friendly procedure.
Madam Chair, Senator Hill, the judgment will be more detailed than the current judgment is. That's true. I can say that it's been user-friendly in Washington State, that that's the system that they've used there to operate the judgments and the information that goes back to the Sentencing Commission. So we're hopeful that it will work at least as well here as it does there.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Any other questions before we move on? Okay. Go ahead, Beth.
I'd like at this point just to have you get out the black booklets. We can start with Table 1. Catherine's got some larger charts. The document that is relevant for you in her presentation is the preliminary first-year report on sentencing guidelines. You have in this booklet a list of the members of the council, a list of the members of the board, the council's enabling legislation, and the next document is what we're calling the preliminary first-year report. There's going to be a very comprehensive first-year report, which will be printed and ready for you the beginning of March, that goes into a great deal more detail than we were taking the time to do here today. This is a preview of it, and we'll have that delivered to the committee council as soon as it is available. Catherine can certainly respond to more detailed questions today, but today's presentation is sort of boiled down to this section of about 10 pages in this booklet. Okay. Catherine, you want to go ahead?
Sure. One of the important outcomes of the guidelines is that they now provide the state and you with the means of monitoring sentencing practices statewide. Under law, courts, as you know, are required to submit these sentencing report forms. Council staff uses them for a number of things. First, and it hasn't been mentioned yet, so I'll note it here, we review each of those and use our computer data entry program to identify errors in sentence calculation. We then notify the court when we've identified a potential error. The court is not obligated to make a change. In your packet, there is a table which outlines the kinds of errors we've identified. They tend to revolve around criminal history and the calculation of the criminal history score under the guidelines. The second thing is that the monitoring system.
Did you say when you spot an error, you communicate it to the court, and the court is not bound to correct the sentence?
That is correct.
So then that means that guideline will not have been correctly followed. Is that the result?
The errors that we identify, Senator Shoemaker, do not always affect sentence.
But they
some do.
And even those don't have to be corrected?
No. The system was designed to try and divert from the Court of Appeals through this administrative procedure a means for the court to make the change prior to appeal. But the court is not under any obligation pursuant to our error letter, to make the change.
You find that the courts generally are correcting, or are they not?
I would say it varies by county and it varies by the type of errors.
Doesn't this offer, isn't this a piece, a bit of mischief that would allow evasion of the guidelines, possibly? Sometimes?
Madam Chair, Senator Shoemaker, it does not alarm us. It does not alarm us to that degree. The first year of the guidelines, we saw confusion around how to calculate criminal history. It very often didn't affect the sentence at all. We returned the forms to the court more as an educational exercise than anything else. And as a matter of fact, we stopped last December sending back sentencing reports. If the error did not affect the sentence at all, we stopped sending back, assuming that the point had been made how to operate the guidelines correctly. We're assuming that if it does affect the sentence, that the judge has the authority to bring the parties back before the court and adjust the sentence. I think what Catherine means is simply that this counsel certainly has no force of law to make the court do that.
Well, thank you.
Secondly, the monitoring system allows us to evaluate the guidelines in a number of areas. I'm going to focus on five of these for you here today. The first is how the guidelines have affected the court processing. Secondly, whether judges are complying with the guidelines, or inversely, whether they are departing from the guidelines and how frequently. Thirdly, they provide a means of looking at sentence uniformity, sentence disparity by race and by gender. Fourth, they allow us to compare the old indeterminate sentencing system with the guidelines in terms of the type of sentences that are being imposed in particular cases. And finally, they allow us to assess the impact of the guideline system on the demand for resources, both state and local. I'll focus here on state or prison resources. My presentation here is a sneak preview of what will ultimately appear in the annual report that should be available in March. There are two documents in your packet or your book, which I will make reference to, are first the last quarterly report, and then secondly the graphic summary. Both of these analyses are based on sentencing report forms received through mid-October. The sample of cases is about 4,200 offenders, felons, sentenced under the guidelines for whom we had received a report. The full annual report will be based on about 6,200 felons. In terms of, we've talked about under-reporting. I wanted to note for the record that I do believe the cases that we have, the report forms that we've received, are representative of the distribution of cases in terms of the types of crimes. They're representative of the population as a whole. So I am confident on that note. In looking at the impact of the guideline system to date, my comparison of pre-guideline sentencing is based on our 1986 sentencing study. I was here before you last session. Many of you may remember that. We collected a statewide sample-based database on 4,000 felons sentenced statewide in 1986. The council used that database to inform itself about sentencing practices and to develop the guidelines. We used that database to project, before the guidelines went into effect, what the impact of them would be. And I'm pleased to report that, for the most part, what we targeted for you when I was here before you last session has played out since the guidelines went into effect 15 months ago. Okay, now my graphics. I'm going to start with court processing. There were a number of fears before the guidelines went into effect about the way they would affect the bringing of a case to disposition and its sentencing. Some of those fears have already been discussed. One is that defendants wouldn't plead under guidelines and the trial rate would go up. In fact, the first set of bars here show that there has not been much change. The yellow is the pre-guidelines 1986 plea rate, percentage of cases disposed of by plea, and the red is the report under the guidelines to date. The slight differential should not be an indication to you that the plea rate has gone up under the guidelines. These cases are slightly less serious, if you will, or the most serious cases have not folded into the guideline sample at a rate we would expect them to in the next year or so, hence the slight differential, I think. Here's the corresponding trial rates, 10% pre-guidelines and 8% since the guidelines have gone into effect. These are the respective rates at which PSIs were ordered in felony cases. Prior to the guidelines in 1986, PSIs were done on 70% of the cases statewide. Since the guidelines have gone into effect, that's been reduced down to 24%. There was a lot of talk before the guidelines went into effect about long contested sentencing hearings as a result of the guidelines. These figures suggest that that is not materialized. Prior to the guidelines, a quarter of the defendants were sentenced on the same day they pled or were found guilty. Under the guidelines, that rate is a little over 50%. These bars compare the average time it takes to move a case from guilty verdict to sentence. Pre-guidelines, it was 48 days. Under guidelines, 14 days. Any questions about?
I'm assuming that, correct me if I'm wrong, that would be an indicator of some cutting of local jail time if they're not waiting around for those, you know, you're saving basically 30 days of local jail time. Somewhere along the line. I mean, isn't that what we're drawing? I mean, never mind the actual number, but that's an indicator of what you're getting out of that.
Madam Chair, that's correct. The numbers of people who are being held awaiting sentencing, the numbers of felons have dropped considerably, freeing up jail space.
And that, Madam Chair, is consistent across almost every county. Oh. Okay. Second area I'm going to focus on is uniformity and compliance with the guidelines, and we don't have any pretty bars to illustrate that. But to date, 94% of the cases sentenced under the guidelines have been consistent with the sentence provided for in the guidelines, both in terms of the disposition, that is whether to sentence to probation or to prison, and in terms of the duration of the sentence or the length of the term. That leaves 6% of the cases which are departure, in which a sentence other than the one.
You haven't moved your chart yet.
No chart.
Madam Chair, we haven't a chart. I'm sorry.
Okay, I've got distracted by that.
This is, I think, Catherine, what figure? Figure 11 in their book?
this is here is in the quarterly report on page 4. Oregon's 6% departure rate so far is somewhere in between the rates that have been reported in the other guideline states that our guidelines were modeled on, that is Washington and Minnesota. The departure rate in Washington has been 4% pretty consistently when they went into effect, In Minnesota, the departure rate has been 8%. So we're somewhere in between. Roughly half of the departure cases are departures in terms of disposition. That is, a sentence of imprisonment is imposed when the guidelines prescribe probation or the inverse. And those are split pretty much 50-50 in terms of their direction. That is, in half of the cases, the judges impose a prison when probation is presumptive, and in the other half, impose probation when prison is presumptive. So there's a split. The other 50% of the departure cases, which are durational departures, or departures in the length of the term set, have been primarily downward departures. In three-quarters of them, the judges have imposed a sentence that is less than what the guidelines provide. Okay, next I want to move to sentence disparity or uniformity. When I reported to you last session on the 1986 sentencing data, I had done an analysis of sentence differentials by race and by gender and had reported that there was some disparity in the decision to impose prison and in the length of prison term that was related to race and to gender that could not be accounted for by the seriousness of the crime or the offender's criminal record. Guidelines, at least theoretically, have the potential to remove some of that in that they systematically relate the sentence to the seriousness of the crime and the offender's record. I can report, and more of this will come in the annual report, I can report that there continues to be a gross differential in the imprisonment rate for whites versus other minorities. For example, the imprisonment rate for whites is 12%, for blacks it's 21%, and for Hispanics it's 24%. That's not controlling for anything, and those statistical controls will have to be applied before we can infer exactly what's going on here and make the comparisons to the 86 data. Another notable thing as to race that I wanted to flag for the committee is that the rate of Hispanics in the felony population has increased, as it has in the state population, but I think it's increased more in the felony population than in the state population. In 1980, Hispanics made up 2.5% of our state population, and the latest 1990 census figures show them as 4% of our state's population. In the 1986 sentencing study, they were 3% of the roughly 8,500 felons. There were 255 of them. In our database on guidelines, they are 15%. Given a population of comparable size, there would be 1,200 of them. So from 255 to 1,200. This in and of itself is not an artifact of the guidelines, but suggests something about how perhaps our law enforcement community may be dealing with Hispanics.
Yes, I wanted to ask you, something came across here just as you were beginning your presentation. What is this an indication of? What does this data indicate?
Madam Chair, Senator Hill, I'm sorry, I don't understand.
Well,
the question.
I'm trying to say what would you describe the data there? I mean, what is it? What are you reporting to us that data indicates?
In 1986, you had 210 Hispanics as a rough, which would amount to 3% of the population. And she's saying now in 1990, well, the last year under sentencing guidelines, when they're tracking, the ones that have been reporting, you're at 15% of the total population would be an equivalence of 1,200, the ratio of 200 to 1,200. And she's not making, and I want to speak for Catherine because I don't know that she's making any judgment or assumption about what that, why, except to say that it seems to be that's the case. I mean, those are the numbers for whatever reason. Either they're a more general, you know, I don't know. You can make your own, we can talk about it and make our own assumptions, I suppose.
I guess then maybe the question I should be asking, in terms of departures, what do you have any data on departures?
Yeah, that's a good question.
Good question, Senator Hill. I don't at the moment. I have looked already at the rates at which optional probation have been imposed for different racial groups. Optional probation is a sentence option that's discretionary for offenders who fall in three grid cells. And a large number of them do, by the way. It's people who are convicted of burglary, delivery and manufacture of drugs. 63% of the whites who are eligible for that optional probation sentence receive it.
Mm-hmm.
For blacks, the rate is 37%. For Hispanics, the rate is 24%.
Mm-hmm.
That, by the way, was something that was flagged for us by the Washington guidelines. They are seeing the same thing there, where there are sentence options for special treatment in the community, whites disproportionately benefit from the options.
And I'm sorry, Madam Chair. And so, when will you have the data on departures?
It'll be a chapter, Senator Hill, in the annual report, and I will certainly look to that as well.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, have you looked at that very same data from the basis of the county? Is there a significant difference between counties in use of options, et cetera? No. You're just looking at statewide totals? I don't know if you're...
Madam Chair and Senator Hamby, I have not yet, but mm-hmm. in the annual report, I think we will want to look at that. The jurisdictional variation in the use mm-hmm. of options. Okay, next I want to turn to look comparatively at the sentences imposed under the guidelines versus the sentences that were imposed before the guidelines went into effect. And here we're pretty much on target. The guidelines were designed to provide the most severe sanctions for serious person offenders. The trade-off was that they had to provide relatively less severe sanctions for non-person or property offenders. In doing this comparison, we're going to look at two things. We're going to look at the percentage that go to prison and the length of stay in prison. In terms of length of stay for the pre-guidelines sample of cases, the durations are projected release dates based on the parole board action forms. The length of stay pre-guidelines includes time that could have been spent on temporary leave before temporary leave was phased out. When we look to guideline sentences, I've computed the average sentence imposed by the trial court and reduced them downward by 10% for the earned credit that they are now eligible for under the guidelines. Offenders are eligible for up to 20%. We don't have any actual data. We haven't seen any cases go through to indicate how much of that they are in fact getting. So I am assuming that every offender gets half. Okay. The first chart, which is figure 5 in your chapter in your book, looks at imprisonment rates by categories of crime. The first set of bars is person crimes. The probability of going to prison pre-guidelines was 34%. Since the guidelines have gone into effect, that's increased to 50%. The trade-off has been that for property offenders, there's been a reduction, 19% pre-guidelines, 8% since the guidelines went into effect. Similarly, there has been a slight reduction in the imprisonment rate for driving offenses. For drug offenses, it's gone up. In 1986, 7% were sentenced to prison on a drug offense. Under the guidelines, 13%. Figure 6 looks at the same categories.
Excuse me, Madam Chair. Yeah. What's in the other category? Just to give some idea.
Well, we could have forgeries, auto theft probably would be, auto theft is a property crime. So the other would be, what else is the other crimes? You know, crimes against the law.
I'm a blank from Craig.
Craig?
Crimes against the law.
You don't even remember.
Stable for the last 6 or 7 months at that 6,200, 6,300 level. It's certainly too early to say that the guidelines are accounting for that stability, but I think it's a possibility. It's a good sign.
Madam Chair, if that be true, would that have any effect on the prison population forecast that was given to us by the witness that preceded you, which has prison populations climbing dramatically between now and 1998, going from a present total population of post-prison supervision and prison population of about 8,500 to almost 24,000. I mean, that's just an incredible increase. Are you suggesting that maybe it won't get that large if guidelines are going to have a tendency to stabilize things? Certainty of sentence, discouraging crime, perhaps?
Madam Chair, Senator Shoemaker, one of the primary parameters driving that November 1 forecast is the projected future rate of increase in court convictions. That forecast assumes that the courts will increase by 8.5% every year the number of felons they sentenced. That parameter is certainly one that will be revisited by the advisory committee when it looks to issue the new forecast. And I suspect they will revise it downward.
When did they do that?
As I mentioned, court filings have been stable, no growth over the last year, nor has there been an increase in the total number of new convictions that corrections has seen.
Okay. So perhaps we shouldn't be unduly alarmed by this prison forecast. At least we ought to wait a while and see what the next one looks like. I see nods.
That's definitely true.
Madam Chair, the concluding segment of the agenda deals with three bills that are in the Council's package of legislation. Before we turn to those, if I might, I would like to take just a couple of minutes for the committee to touch briefly on the other bills that will be coming in the package.
Right.
The first of which, and I alluded to it earlier in response to a question from Senator Hill, will be the bill that contains some statutory amendments related to felony guidelines, further amendments, and the language that would purport to approve the additional rules amendments that the board has enacted subject to legislative approval. And of course, those rules amendments will come in separately for your review as a document. A second bill that relates to the felony guidelines goes back to a provision that the legislature included in the 1989 omnibus bill, House Bill 2250, and that was a provision that directed the board to adopt for legislative consideration rules which would enhance guidelines penalties in three areas. The presumptive sentence for delivery, manufacture, and distribution of controlled substances. That was priority area number one. The second was increasing the maximum period of imprisonment for violation of post-prison supervision. And the third was to increase the presumptive sentences for violent crimes against persons. The board has adopted rules, amendments, which would make changes in each of those areas. And a separate bill approving those changes will be before you. Whether any of those particular enhancements will be feasible as a matter of resources will be, of course, another question that will have to be confronted by this committee, perhaps by Ways and Means, depending on actions of the subject committees here. But that will be dealt with as a separate bill, those three enhancement areas. A third bill, again going back to provisions in House 2250 that directed the development of recommended structure of sentencing for misdemeanors, will be a bill that purports to make changes in statutes controlling misdemeanor sentencing and approves rules dealing with misdemeanor sentencing, and those rules, which were adopted subject to your approval, will also be presented for your review along with that legislation. So there will be two bills on felony sentencing guidelines and one on misdemeanor sentencing guidelines. Kathleen will quickly summarize the rest of the package, and then we'll go to the public hearing if we may. Chairman.
Okay, I have a question. And I guess it's a request. Has the Guidelines Board made any other alternatives that would show us what your projection, not this other group that are trying to do it on the basis of some economics somewhere? What your projections would have to take into account if we were not to augment the governor's budget as projected, i.e., the not opening of the rental to others, to the feds or someone else, that those prison beds which are scheduled to be brought online.
Madam Chair, if I understand, you're asking whether or not reductions in the guidelines have been considered that would have to flow if that did not occur?
Well, I'm assuming that it's not going to occur because it's the governor's budget and the ticket is probably $35 million, and I don't know of anybody right now who may or may not be willing to find $35 million to put into opening prison beds,
right,
or non-rental of prison beds. So I'm wondering whether the board has done anything to look at the guidelines in the context of the governor's proposed budget.
I would say as a board, not yet. There has been more informal work underway at the staff level, okay, looking at potential ways to make adjustments in policies if the resources approved by the Assembly are less than those that are projected to be needed if there are no changes made in the guidelines. And the legislature did put into House Bill 2250 a mechanism by which the board is empowered, if the legislature itself takes no action, to make adjustments if, in fact, demand is outrunning resources. That mechanism is included. It hasn't been activated yet, but it is there. My supposition, Madam Chair, would be, however, that if it looks like the approved resources compared to the most current available projection are going to be less than the projection, my assumption is that there would be initially proposals, hopefully as workable as possible for the Assembly to consider, that would change sanctioning policy to bring those two in line. And there may be ways that that can be accomplished without actually dealing with the grid, per se.
Yeah, I just guess. I think at some point somebody's going to look at the governor's budget and assume that that's where we are for now. And the governor's budget is, what, 550-bed shortfall based on where we thought we were last year at a minimum. I think something like that.
That's enough. We'll get to that in reality of all. Senator
Gale. Can I ask you one question? In connection with that, Hardy, you mentioned that the bill to enhance penalties for drug dealing and crimes against persons and so forth. Now, how does that fit? And I mean, suppose that the bill passes. Suppose the bill passes, then what do you do, even if the resources are limited? Or do you say that that does not take effect, or does it just take effect within the limits of the resources?
I think, Madam Chair, Senator Hill, I think that it would be a question of not making the changes at all if the resources are not going to be approved to go with them. That's
what I'm be a combination. That, I mean, given that sentencing guidelines are a way of allocating prison space, if we say that something is more important than others, I mean, given I think what we're saying is that we want some things enhanced within the resources that we have, even although that may be less than what would be desirable, I'm a little concerned that you wouldn't implement it at all. If we had changed the guidelines to indicate that we wanted, say, big drug dealers, the successful drug dealers, however you want to describe them, are a priority, crimes against persons are a priority, I mean, what? I guess I'm asking you, what difference does it make what resources are available? You're going to have, the whole system has got to adjust to whatever resources are available, I would think.
Well, Senator Cohen, Madam Chair, Senator Hill, yes, except that by eliminating temporary leave, I think that's probably the most significant change. The legislature has really eliminated the way in which the system sort of fudged, I would say, along the way previously to deal with overruns in capacity. And I think it would be our view that when you're looking at numbers of demand for resources, that total demand needs to be viewed as a real total, and that there won't be any way to accommodate to it other than by making either increasing resources or by making changes elsewhere in sanctions to offset the greater priority you want to put somewhere else. The bill dealing with enhancements, those rules amendments, are kept separate for purposes of your consideration from the sort of basic felony guidelines amendments, because I think it was our assumption you would want to look at those enhancements after you've worked through the other more basic kinds of changes to see what resources those will demand. And they will require some, not dramatic amounts, but some.
Okay, well, I guess we're sort of discussing what do you consider to be basic. I mean, crimes against persons, let's set the drug thing aside because of the things that Senator Springer mentioned, but crimes against persons, I mean, if we say that that's a priority and that we feel that the sentences should be longer for that category, I guess what we're saying is that we say that with the understanding that something else is going to have to give in terms of space. And I just want to be sure that we have an understanding of that.
Do you all,
Madam Chair, Senator Hill, yes.
And I did you all recommend whatever else gives?
Madam Chair, no, at this point, no. Quite frankly, if I may add to that, Madam Chair,
I think that at the time
that the enhancements changes were adopted for consideration by the legislature, it was the view of the council and of the board, for the most part, that unless the figures we've seen about projected resources, the guidelines otherwise would require, change dramatically, it would be extremely difficult for the legislature to adopt any of those enhancements. That new resources will be required just to deal with the guidelines without the enhancements. Now, if the legislature decides nonetheless to make enhancements, and it does not direct other changes to be made, offsetting changes, and it does not provide the resources to deal with the enhancements, then ultimately, I think, one outcome is that we fall back on that process by which the board has to make adjustments under those provisions of 2250.
Right. So we'd have to figure out how much.
Mm-hmm. Well, Madam Chair, I don't know, maybe we're kind of, see the basic format that we've created as being a little more fixed maybe than I would. For example, if we just suddenly had a rash, well, let's see, for example, I guess factually, I recently read that sex crimes have increased. Okay, so if we make a determination that we want to do something to make those sentences longer, and when we have the full understanding that something else is going to have to go down, we're saying as a legislature, if we make the policy that we want this to be enhanced, even within whatever resources are available, I would like to at least be able to understand or take a look, because we're saying that is a priority. And so some else that we realize is something else is going to have to give. We're not saying do more with less resources, but we would want that taken into account. And I think that's a policy decision that we might make. And if we did that, I would like to maybe get some. This is all based on priorities, so I think you would go back through and whatever considered to be the least offensive crimes would be somehow reduced to make room for that one. I just want to be sure that is possible to do, and we'd be looking to you, I guess, for some guidance as to how to do that.
Senator Cohen, Madam Chair, Senator Hill, yes, we would certainly try to give you options, so to speak, that could provide offsetting reductions, assuming no increase in resources. But
right.
You wanted to change allocation priorities, change priorities in the response of those. When I mentioned that one of those options might well not involve changing the grid itself, as has been mentioned, the percentage of admissions accounted for by returns from parole or post-prison supervision is very, very dramatic. And if there's a payoff area where there might be a possibility of, in effect, increasing capacity without changing the sanctioning policy of the grid, it would be in the direction of trying, an acceptable way to bring down that return rate.
Well, I would think that needs to be done anyway, but I guess I'd just say it depends on what they did to cause them to be returned.
Of course.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Other questions? Sir Hemby.
Only a thought. If I recall, Fred Peirce recommended Dr. Matt Cutt, if you recall, and a number of probation officers. Certainly, if there's no out in the field supervision, you're not going to get that high rate of return coming back.
Just so if you take them all away, right?
Yeah.
They'll have to process, squeeze them through the 10%, the 8% increase of the court under new cases.
Well, that's one way, mm-hmm. I guess.
Anything else? Anyone else? That's kind of how things work in this mm-hmm. business, though. Okay, we haven't heard from Judge Ellis, so who's going to come up and talk about the bill?
Judge Ellis is going to come up, actually.
Good. Is he on the list for the... And Eric Wasserman is here as well.
I guess he's...
Eric was here before.
Do you want to start with... which bill would you like to start with?
We have 10 minutes, folks, so we can start with whomever you like.
We start with Senate Bill 616, that's the council.
Right, okay.
Bill.
Okay.
The Senate Bill 616 is a bill that does two things primarily. One is the council's been operating under a sunset date since it was created in 1985. This committee passed legislation in the last session to repeal the sunset date, and on the House side it was amended to give us a sunset date in 1991 instead. So if this legislative assembly does not act at all, the council will cease to exist on July the 1st, 1991. So this is a bill that repeals the council's sunset. It also repeals some redundant or some obsolete pieces of our statutory language, which is quite a jumble of uncodified law that appears at the end of Chapter 423. And it also adds language, page 2 of the bill, Section 4, which plays a large role in this bill summary, requiring the council staff to review the sentencing forms for error and to return them to the sentencing court. That was, in fact, language that you all passed in the last session as part of the guidelines omnibus bill, House Bill 2250. It did not make it into the final form of the bill, I think, through oversight in legislative council or somewhere along the road. So Section 4 adds that language into the statute. We've been doing that, but there is no statutory language that tells us to do that. The other changes are correcting citations. There's an emergency clause on the bill so that if the assembly is still in session on July the 1st, that the council would continue. I would be more than happy to go through and tell you the sections that we're repealing and why, if you want to take the time to do that. They're tasks that we've already completed or language that appears twice, basically, in different parts of the statute.
Okay. There are questions of Kathleen with respect to Senate Bill 616. Okay. There's no one else signed up on that bill either, so why don't we move ahead then to your next bill?
Senate Bill 619 is Judge Ellis, so Judge Ellis, if you come up.
Welcome. Madam Chair, I'm James Ellis, Circuit Judge, Multnomah County. The 89 session directed that uniform bail provisions for or security deposit provisions be developed for release of pretrial of people charged with crimes in Oregon. That has been accomplished. It was done by a directive from the Chief Justice setting forth a schedule to be followed by all the courts in the state. As a part of the development process, the Criminal Justice Council, and I'm also one of the two judge members of the council, the Criminal Justice Council put together a subcommittee to come up with proposed standards, and in the course of that turned up three very narrow areas where the subcommittee felt and convinced the council that some legislation was needed, and that's what this bill deals with, three fairly narrow areas. First, citations are used to commence most infraction violation, that is, non-criminal offense charges, and a large number of criminal charges, misdemeanors and some felonies. A uniform form of citation is prescribed in Oregon, most of the contents set forth by statute. The bill would add a provision for the signature of the person cited. That is a common procedure in other states. It has not been a part of the Oregon procedure. There would have been a cost to this provision because it would have required redesigning all of the citations used by all the law enforcement agencies. However, the Chief Justice also has authority for prescribing format, and just by coincidence, as far as I know, or perhaps by design, and I was just not aware of it, the latest directive includes a provision for a signature of the person cited. The reasons for making the change is, first, it offers a protection to a citizen from having some alleged offender give that citizen's name when stopped. If I'm stopped, I can say to the policeman, I don't have my driver's license with me, but my name is Hardy Myers. And the officer copies that down and writes a citation charging Hardy Myers with an offense. And I pocket the citation, and after the officer's out of sight, water it up and throw it away and don't appear in court, and ultimately that innocent citizen's license gets suspended for not appearing in court. The second problem that it is hoped this will is to discourage the violators from giving a false name, because it forces the violator not only to give a false name, but then to commit forgery by signing that name. The third is to discourage alleged violators from appearing in court, perhaps 6 months or a year later, because they, the alleged violator chose not to appear on the date cited, to then appear and say, I didn't get the ticket. It was given to somebody else. By then, the officer who issued the citation, we had no idea, couldn't begin to say, that's the person I gave the citation to. So in that kind of argument, the offender ordinarily wins. Having given his signature, it provides some opportunity for the prosecutor to say, this is the person. You can compare the signatures. The for the person who does show their driver's license, if a person has a stolen driver's license or stolen ID, there's a possibility that even though they may look similar enough, they may not be able to sign, and the driver's license has a signature on it. Gives the officer the opportunity to compare signatures. And finally, it is hopeful that perhaps a higher percentage of defendants may appear having signed a statement that contains the date on which they're to appear. The second portion of the bill is we have release officers around the state. Some are court employees in larger counties. Some are designated by the court because it's the presiding judge's responsibility, pretrial release. But in some smaller communities, they designate a law enforcement officer, a jailer, or somebody of that sort. The ones who are not law enforcement officers do not have arrest powers. Some of the release programs require people to come in and report from time to time, and it's frequently the release officer who first becomes aware that a release agreement is being violated by an alleged offender. And the release officers don't have the power to arrest. For instance, a person's on a condition that they not use drugs, and they come in and either from observation or from urinalysis, obviously, or under the influence of drugs. The release officer at present has no authority to take action, and what they have to do is call a police officer, but the police officer also doesn't have authority because it's not a felony, and it was not, officers can't arrest for, except in limited circumstances, unless they see the offense, and this is not a new crime. The original suggestion was to make give release officers arrest powers. That has significant financial impact because it would require training, and it raises liability issues. What the release people came up with is to give law enforcement officers the authority to arrest based on information and belief that a release agreement has been violated, so that the release officer could simply call a deputy sheriff or city police officer and say, this person's out on a release order that precludes, for instance, use of drugs, and is now, we have urinalysis positive for drug use or something of that sort, so that the officer could make the arrest to get the person back into custody for a hearing on whether or not there's been a violation. The third provision in the bill is a very narrow one, and that is that we have a number of counties in Oregon that are under federal court order directing that the sheriff release people, even though the courts have not authorized the release, in order to keep the population of the jail within a cap set by a federal court order. And one of the problems we ran into is that occasionally those people are released, and the stories we heard were quite commonly, without being given a date to appear in court. And when that occurs, the whole process kind of grinds to a halt. The person can't be charged with failure to appear since they've been told to appear. The court has no basis for revoking their release for violating a release agreement because they didn't agree to appear. And about all the court can do is start all over again with a warrant and have them taken into custody, which gets you right back to square one again. This would simply require that when a sheriff releases, that the sheriff must obtain their promise to do at least two things that are ordinarily included in a release agreement directed by the court, and that is first to appear in court at a certain date and time and place, and second, to obey the laws while out on release. That one has some additional burden in that it's something sheriffs would have to do that evidently some of them, or their staff rather, may not always do now, but it shouldn't be a significant thing, you know, in that most of them are probably having them sign something before they walk out the door. And I'd be happy to respond to any questions.
Thank you. Other question? Would you like to take just a minute or two and go over your perception of the possession issue for a moment while we have you here?
I would.
Especially in Multnomah County, and then...
Bang the gavel if I'm taking too much of your time. And I'm just giving you my impressions. The danger of this is that this is anecdotal rather than the precise information that you get from the Criminal Justice Council. But first, law enforcement policy can fluctuate these things enormously, just as they can in most of the victimless crimes. If any law enforcement agency wants to concentrate on a particular thing, it can immediately produce an increase in those crimes, driving under the influence typically, and especially the drug offenses and prostitution, the three that occur to me. You can have an epidemic anytime just by order of a police chief where you have those kind of crimes. The another factor that affects us in Multnomah County, and I know and I suspect perhaps all up and down the Interstate 5 corridor, and that is that there's an enormous flow of heroin up from Mexico, the tar heroin, and there are large numbers of people, evidently, if the jail population and the cases tell you anything, that are in this country illegally selling tar heroin. They're particularly a burden to local communities because when they are arrested, then the Immigration Service lodges a hold on them, and they can't be released pre-trial, even though the amounts may be minute. So they occupy jail beds. They're also very expensive for the courts because most of them, while they may be able to conduct their drug business in English, they are not willing to appear in court and speak English. They ask for an interpreter, and that has to be provided at public expense, in addition to an appointed lawyer, to the point now where we have a substantial number in Multnomah County of people who a significant part of their income is earned serving as interpreters for people primarily in the Spanish language. And a lot of these are minute quantities and are at least in some cases charged as scheme or network, because one of the ways they do business is the person who does the negotiating doesn't hold the drugs. They have another fellow standing nearby, and it may have a minute quantity, a couple of dots, and these dots are minute. They look like Tootsie Rolls, and I've had discussions in court about with a plastic envelope, this is the dot here. No, that's an imperfection in the plastic. This is the dot over here. We're talking about very small quantities in some cases. And the whole inventory may be three dots. One person is holding the three.